From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We're just trying to be more voices, more people behind Troy Davis, supporting the movement that he's a part of in the face of a really horrible injustice that could happen here.
The state of Georgia is scheduled to execute death row prisoner Troy Davis Monday. The Supreme Court decided last week it would not hear his appeal. This after his execution was put off twice. We'll get the latest. But first, the presidential campaign.
I think his plans of our redistribution of the wealth. He said it himself. We need to spread the wealth around. Now,
that's one of the tenets
of socialism.
Is Barack Obama a socialist and is being called one a smear? We'll speak with Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's Magazine. And voters' rights groups file a federal lawsuit in Pennsylvania seeking emergency paper ballots. We'll speak with John Boniface of Voter Action. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan appeared before lawmakers Thursday and admitted his long-held anti-regulation views are flawed. Speaking before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Greenspan said he had erred in seeing markets as self-disciplining.
I made a mistake in presuming that the self-interest of organizations, specifically banks and others, were such as that they were best capable of protecting their own shareholders and the equity in the firms.
During his Fed stint, Greenspan rejected a series of regulatory measures critics say could have helped prevent the economic crisis. On the campaign trail, a series of new polls show an increasing lead for Senator Barack Obama over Senator John McCain. Several polls show Obama ahead in key battleground states, including Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida. Nate Silver of the polling website 538.com says McCain's chance of winning the election has dwindled down to 3.7%. down from 6.5% on Thursday, Obama campaigned in Indiana.
More tax cuts for jobs outsourcing. That's what Senator McCain proposed as his answer to outsourcing. He said that's, quote, simple fundamental economics. Well, Indiana, my opponent may call that fundamental economics, but we know that's just another name for Wall Street first, Main Street last. That's the kind of economic philosophy we've had for the past 8 years. And that's fundamentally wrong.
McCain was in Florida, where he continued to invoke Joe the Plumber to portray Obama as a tax and spend Democrat.
He believes in redistributing the wealth, not in policies that grow our economy and create jobs and opportunities for all Americans. Senator Obama is more interested in controlling who gets your piece of the pie than he is in growing the pie. You know, whether it's Joe the Plumber in Ohio or Joe over here, thank you, Joe. Joe, thank you. There's Joes all over here. The small business owners I met with this morning here in Florida, we shouldn't be taxing our small businesses more, as Senator Obama wants to do.
Obama, meanwhile, has picked up the endorsement of another former Bush administration official days after former Secretary of State Colin Powell gave his backing. Former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan told CNN's Deal Hughley he also will be voting for Obama.
From the very beginning, I've said I'm going to support the candidate that has the best chance of changing the way Washington works and getting things done. I will be voting for Barack Obama.
Oh!
Earlier this year, McClellan broke ranks and criticized the White House over the war in Iraq, the handling of Hurricane Katrina, and the leak of CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity. Obama received another Republican endorsement Thursday from Cece Goldwater, the granddaughter of former Republican senator and presidential candidate Barry Goldwater. Meanwhile, Republicans have been dealt new setbacks in seeking to block thousands of people from voting on Election Day. The website alternate.org reports Republicans lost court challenges in three key states Thursday. In Ohio and Wisconsin, judges rejected suits seeking a recertification of those voters whose records don't match other government databases. And in Nevada, a judge denied a Republican attempt seeking to prevent voters from correcting registration information at the polls. Meanwhile, a group of voter and civil rights groups have sued the state of Pennsylvania to demand emergency paper ballots be distributed when 50% or more electronic voting machines become inoperable at any polling site in the state. The lawsuit was filed after Pennsylvania's Secretary of State ordered counties to provide emergency paper ballots only if every electronic voting machine breaks down at a voting site. The plaintiffs include the NAACP, the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia, and Voter Action. We'll be joined by John Boniface of Voter Action later in the broadcast. The community organizing group ACORNS revised the tally from a major national voter registration drive. ACORN affiliate Project Vote says the campaign signed up 450,000 voters, not 1.3 million, the group initially claimed. The remainder is made up by either registered voters who've changed their addresses and another 400,000 rejected on several grounds. In Iraq, protests continue against the proposed security pact that would allow U.S. forces to stay in Iraq for at least three more years. On Thursday, lawmakers with the Sadr bloc held a sit-in against the current proposals.
It is a clear message to the Iraqi government, U.S. government, the occupation, and to all the honest and patriotic people who work for the sake of Iraq's unity, land, people, flag, and sovereignty, those who work for the right and just, to join us and make Iraq's sovereignty and national interest above all.
The draft calls for a full U.S. withdrawal by 2012, but leaves open the possibility of a later date. U.S. soldiers would also retain immunity from prosecution for all actions except those committed off-duty and not in combat. Critics have dismissed the provision because U.S. troops seldom leave their bases in Iraq unless on authorized missions. In Colombia, tens of thousands of indigenous Colombians continue their national march against the government of President Álvaro Uribe. The crowd set out Thursday, just hours after Uribe admitted police officers fired on them in a protest earlier this week. Indigenous leader Lorenzo Muelas denounced Uribe.
President Uribe is not a friend of the indigenous groups. We know that many of the laws he passed through Congress are anti-indigenous.
In other news from Colombia, Uribe's top intelligence chief has resigned after acknowledging her agency spied on some of Uribe's political opponents. DAS head Maria del Pilar Hurtado blamed the spying on individual agents, but opposition Senator Gustavo Petro said the order likely came from Uribe.
Who else could have given that order if it wasn't the intelligence chief? That is a question that the Colombian president, who is directly responsible for the Police Security Administrative Department, should give us in order to satisfy our demands to make a real democracy in Colombia and not the military state that seems to be what is happening in Colombia.
Meanwhile, at least five people were injured in a series of small explosions around the capital, Bogota, Thursday. In Mexico, lawmakers have approved a measure that would allow private involvement in the nationalized oil sector. Former Mexican presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador led protests against the vote. He called the move a setback for Mexico.
Not in policies that help.
Un momento importante en la historia del país, porque...
It's an important moment in the history of the country because we don't accept handing over Mexican territory to foreign companies to exploit and drill oil wells.
Back in the United States, the White House says it will revive a major crackdown on undocumented immigrants in President Bush's remaining months. The administration will seek court approval to ask hundreds of thousands of employers to validate some 8.7 million Social Security numbers. The directive will tell the employers to resolve discrepancies or fire the workers within 90 days. And here in New York, the city councils voted to undo term limits that would have barred Mayor Michael Bloomberg from seeking re-election. The term limits have twice been approved in referenda by New York voters. Opponents are planning a legal challenge. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Well, Juan, that was a very acrimonious debate yesterday in the New York City Council around the issue of term limits.
Yes, some people are calling it the initiation of the Banana Republic in New York City now. You had a vote of the city council, very close vote, 29 to 22, as you said in the headlines, overturning a decision twice made by the voters in votes to keep term limits. And this has happened with lightning speed in only 3 weeks. So it was only 3 weeks ago that Mayor Bloomberg announced that he wanted to stay for a third term, and he had the support only of the editorial boards of all the major papers, including the New York Times and the business community. But 89% of New Yorkers wanted to have another vote on this matter. The mayor didn't want to vote, so he pushed it through. He threatened community organizations that were receiving city funding or funding from his own private foundation, pressured them to come and testify on his behalf. And now you have the situation now where it's a court challenge. It's likely not going to pass. And I think one of the city council members, Charles Barron from Brooklyn, actually said, look, even in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez wanted to stay as president. He wanted to eliminate term limits. He had a vote. And he urged Mayor Bloomberg to follow the example of Hugo Chavez and have a vote.
And
the mayor
declined. There were a number of council members who are not opposed to ending term limits, but they just said there should be a referendum and it shouldn't be they that are deciding in the city council.
Right, because actually all the city council members will also get an additional term. But the thing about it, this is what makes it so ironic, is that the mayor actually indicated that he'd be willing to appoint a commission to change the charter once again to bring back two term limits after he's gone. So this is only an attempt to change the limits for one man, in effect. Well, as the presidential race enters the final stretch, Senator John McCain and several of his key advisors have been sharpening a new line of attack against Senator Barack Obama, charging that his tax plan amounts to socialism. McCain first inserted the charge into an address he recorded for broadcast Sunday on talk radio stations.
My opponent's answer showed that economic recovery isn't even his top priority. His goal, as Senator Obama put it, is to, quote, spread the wealth around. You see, he believes in redistributing wealth, not in policies that help us all make more of it. Joe, in his plain-spoken way, said this sounded a lot like socialism. And a lot of Americans are thinking along those same lines. In the best case, spreading the wealth around is a familiar idea from the American left. And that kind of class warfare sure doesn't sound like a new kind of politics. In other words, Barack Obama's tax plan would convert the IRS into a giant welfare agency, redistributing massive amounts of wealth at the direction of politicians in Washington. I suppose when you voted against lowering taxes 94 times, as Senator Obama has done, a new definition of the term tax credit comes in handy. At least in Europe, the socialist leaders who so admire my opponent are upfront about their objectives.
Many of McCain's supporters picked up on the charge that Obama advocates socialist policies, and the issue made its rounds in the corporate media.
Socialism, it's come up on the campaign trail now.
Sure.
Governor, is Barack Obama a socialist?
No, there is a free lunch.
What is the free lunch?
The free lunch is that you're taking the wealthy in America, the big earners, okay? Right. You're taking money away from them, and you're giving it to people who don't. That's called income redistribution. It's a socialist tenet.
Bill.
Come on, you know that. You went to Harvard.
There's no question that Barack Obama has been steeped in and marinated with the socialist ethos from the time he studied at Columbia University.
For months, I've been telling you, Barack Obama, and more his wife than Barack, I mean, at least looking at her language, I believe there's a socialist agenda there for America.
When you punish people for making more money and you reward them for nothing, that is socialism, and that's
Governor,
a terrible, terrible way for this country to move.
Governor,
on Fox News Sunday, host Chris Wallace asked McCain directly about the issue.
But you did it indirectly. So let me ask you for some straight talk. Do you think that Senator Obama is a socialist? Do you think that his plans are socialism?
I think his plans are redistribution of the wealth. He said it himself. We need to spread the wealth around. Now,
is that
that's
socialism?
That's one of the tenets of socialism, but it's more the liberal left, which he's always been on. He's always been in the left lane of American politics. That's why he voted 94 times against any tax cuts or for tax increases. That's why he voted for the Democratic resolution, a budget resolution, that would impose taxes on, raise taxes on some individual who makes $42,000 a year. That's why he has the most liberal voting record in the United States.
But Senator, when we talk
is one of the tenets of socialism redistribution of the wealth? Not just socialism, a lot of other liberal and left-wing philosophies. Redistribution of the wealth? I don't believe in it. I believe in wealth creation by Joe the Plumber.
But Senator, you voted for the $700 billion bailout that's being used partially to nationalize American banks. Isn't that socialism?
That is reacting to a crisis that's due to greed and excess in Washington. And what this administration is doing wrong and what Paulson is doing wrong is not going out and buying up home mortgages, and giving people new mortgages at the new value of their home so they can stay in their home. They're bailing out the banks. They're bailing out these institutions.
But you voted for that.
Of course, it was a package that had to be enacted because the economy was about to go into the tank.
Is Barack Obama a socialist, and is being called a socialist a smear? Rick MacArthur's publisher and president of Harper's Magazine, award-winning journalist and author. His latest book is You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. He joins us in the Firehouse studio. He's got the latest issue of MacArthur's How to Save Capitalism. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
Well, is Barack Obama a socialist?
Barack Obama is a socialist like Harper's Magazine is a media conglomerate. It's the most preposterous charge I've heard in a pretty crazy campaign. When they keep saying that Barack Obama puts socialism ahead of entrepreneurship, I keep thinking of the vast amount of money he's been collecting from Wall Street for his campaign. His number one bundler is Goldman Sachs, which has given him up to this point, I think about $740,000. The New York Times just the other day has revealed that there's a new way the two campaigns have come up with to get cash out of Wall Street, and this is Democrats and Republicans alike, with these joint campaign committees. 12 Goldman Sachs employees were revealed in this latest report to have given more than $25,000 apiece to Obama's campaign. You could make the argument that Barack Obama always puts Wall Street first. I'm not going to make that argument because I don't know how he's going to turn out as president. But up to this point, he's been a champion of Wall Street interests. His number one economic advisor is Robert Rubin, the senior executive or chairman of the executive committee of Citigroup, the former Treasury secretary. The guy who, alongside Alan Greenspan, was arguing against a regulation of the derivatives market in the 1990s very forcefully. And in his own book, in The Audacity of Hope, Obama talks a lot about how much he admires investment bankers, how much he likes bankers, how he feels comfortable with them and with corporate lawyers. So it's an absurd charge. But it's even more absurd when you realize that, as Chris Wallace pointed out in that clip, John McCain, Robert Rubin, they're all socialists now. The only one who's not a socialist, apparently, is Alan Greenspan. He's just shocked at what's happened. He's suddenly found a flaw in the plot of one of his Ayn Rand novels. I'm not sure exactly what the plot flaw is, because he doesn't specify. But the notion that this is a left-right argument is absurd. Is patently absurd, given where the money is coming from to finance these campaigns. Now, if Obama gets out there and denounces Wall Street, that's fine. The question is, and McCain is doing the same thing, greed on Wall Street is a constant in our history. The question now is a President Obama going to take this crisis, going to take this possible mandate? Because apparently, it's backfiring for McCain. The polls are widening. Obama's going further and further ahead. It seems to suggest that the American people are saying, hey, socialism, this sounds pretty good. if he's a socialist, I'm for it. Everybody seems to be for it. What's he going to do with this mandate? Is he going to appoint one of the usual suspects as Treasury Secretary, or is he going to do something different? Is he going to do something more specific about regulating these markets? Or is he going to rely on the advice of people like Robert Rubin?
Well, but his apparent definition of socialism as redistribution of the wealth sort of negates the fact that American taxation policy, at least at the federal level, has always been a progressive taxation policy. The more money you make, the higher you get taxed. So that this has been part of the American history since the development of our tax system.
Well, since 1912, mm-hmm. when we instituted an income tax, when the top rate in 1964, the last time we had this kind of crazy debate between the Goldwater Republicans and Lyndon Johnson, the top marginal rate was 91%. Barack Obama is only proposing to raise or restore the top marginal rate from the current 35% to 39.6%, which is what it was under the Clinton administration. This is a very modest, very, you might even say, timid response to what's, in the last 15 years, been a redistribution of wealth from the bottom up to the top. What is the mortgage crisis except Wall Street picking on people who don't know better, who are not very well educated about the finance market, and really robbing them, taking the money up to the top? That's redistribution of wealth.
And isn't also the issue of capital gains tax versus income tax, that's where the real money is in the capital gains tax, and Obama has not been very radical in that, has he?
Well, he's proposing an increase from the current 15% to 25%, which is where it's been more or less for the last 60 or 70 years. It's fluctuated in the 20s and the 30s. But the important thing to know about that is Obama, in his quest for campaign money and votes, was in a conflict of interest. John Edwards pushed him a little bit to the left when he persuaded him to call for a change in the tax code so that you would tax hedge fund partner income at the regular personal income tax rate instead of at the capital gains rate. So instead of paying 15%, they'd be paying today 35%. But he stopped talking about that in the last 3, 4, 5 months. You don't hear him talking about that anymore. And I think that's a kind of a compromise he's made, where he says, well, at least if we raise capital gains from 15 to 25, the hedge fund partners will have to at least pay 25%. But that's still a lot less than the top personal income tax rate of 35 or 39%.
I mean, it's amazing that the McCain campaign is using this line of attack, because they supported the bailout. Now, I'm not saying the bailout was socialist, but it does involve nationalizing debt and, well, ultimately privatizing the profit. The guys that incurred the debt now have now gain profit, if there is profit, and taxpayers pay for the debt. But it was the Democrats joining with the Republicans in endorsing this bailout. And now he's attacking Obama for what he did. In fact, if he had said he was against the bailout, voted against it, and of course it still would have passed, he could well have surged forward, because that's the feeling of the American people.
Yes, if McCain had wanted to follow popular sentiment, the popular opinion was overwhelmingly against the bailout. Obama and McCain were side by side whipping their caucuses, as they say in Congress, to vote for it after the rebellion in the House. The rebellion in the House, which we should remember, is what used to be known as the People's House. It's supposed to be the closest instrument of government to the will of the people. They voted against the first bailout bill. They rejected it. People were shocked. That was shocking. And leadership of the two parties, including Obama and McCain, got together to push through the second deal. Is this socialism or is this collusion between the two parties? I'm not saying there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two candidates. Clearly, there's a difference. Anybody who would put their blurb on a Reinhold Niebuhr book, which is what Barack Obama has in one of his has done, is obviously a thoughtful person, and he's educable. But up to this point, he's shown absolutely nothing to suggest that he's anything like a left-winger. He's a centrist, a prudent centrist conservative. You could make the argument he's the conservative candidate.
What is a socialist and why is it a smear?
Well, a socialist believes in real government control of industry, of takeover of private enterprise, which is an argument we're going to have in the next 6 months. If the auto industry collapses, which is a real possibility, there's going to be an argument about whether we should save certain industries, nationalize certain industries like they do in Europe. For a long time, Renault was owned by the government of France, and then eventually they privatized it. Are we going to take over General Motors? Are we going to take over Chrysler? Are we going to take over Ford in order to save national industries? We aren't even at the point now where we're arguing about real socialism. At this point, we're talking about, as you say, debt nationalization of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But we're not at the point now where we're discussing the real tenets of socialism, which is state control of major industries and national economic planning. I think we need national economic planning. I'm not sure if we need state takeovers of industries, but this is something we're going to have to decide as the recession bites.
But even state takeovers don't necessarily mean socialism, because clearly in the midst of the Depression, many of the advanced capitalist countries opted for two forms of intervention. You had the fascist intervention, which also involved some state takeovers of industries, or at least direct government control of them, as well as the more liberal democratic models of the United States and England. So just a mere fact of states intervening in a crisis doesn't necessarily mean you're going socialist. You could also be going fascist.
Well, we could be going fascist, but in another direction. But we're also talking about worker control to some extent. If we go a little further left, mm-hmm. we're talking about worker control of industries, or citizen control of industries, not government ownership, strictly speaking. So if we get to the point where the United Auto Workers Union is asked to participate, let's say, in the bailout of General Motors or the bailout of Chrysler or Ford, are we going to give the United Auto Workers ownership stake in these corporations? These are the things we're going to have to deal with. The recession is going to be severe.
Rick MacArthur, I called your magazine MacArthur's. I meant Harper's. Yeah. But it's How to Save Capitalism is the whole series of articles, with everyone from Joe Stiglitz to Michael Hudson, the advisor to Dennis Kucinich. How do you save capitalism? Should you save capitalism?
Well, I want to save people. I mean, we're interested in proposing ideas here that will save the American people. I'm not sure if you're going to call it socialism or semi-socialism or semi or mixed economy, whatever you want to call it. But these are seven or eight articles, sort of long op-ed pieces, proposing specific things that could alleviate the crisis. I mean, you got Joe Stiglitz making a very simple and interesting suggestion here. He says a simple regulation requiring mortgage originators to put their own money at risk in each transaction, say 20% of the loan amount, would curb some of the abusive practices that have taken place. Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Tyagi suggest the creation of a consumer product safety commission for financial products. Simple idea, just like we have. They talk about how we've had these tremendous advances in consumer protection when you buy a toaster, but not when you buy a mortgage, so to speak, or a stock or a bond. Bill McKibben talks about relocalizing the economy. We're wasting vast amounts of money using fossil fuels to transport, thanks to free trade, quote unquote, to transport products all over the world so that they can be made in cheap labor locales and then sold in richer areas. The cost of fossil fuel is going to continue to go up. It's going to continue to diminish as a resource. We need to localize. We need to grow food close to where we eat it, for example. There are other examples, but it's a collection of pieces that offer practical solutions. We need industrial planning. That's what my friend here, Eric Jansen, says. We need to reindustrialize the country. But to reindustrialize the country, you have to have a coherent central planning mechanism. But when you say central planning, people like John McCain or John Stormer, the guy in 1964 who wrote Goldwater's Ur-Text, none dare call it treason, they think Soviet Union. Central planning means Soviet Union. It means bureaucrats getting into everybody's personal life. But there are a lot of things we could do short of outright government takeover or outright socialism or communism that could improve the situation.
You wrote, "You can't be president, the outrageous barriers to democracy in America." We just have 30 seconds. But given the situation as it stands now, do you still feel that way? Or even more?
Well, I think that the amount of money that's been poured into the campaign, we're going to get up to $1 billion by the end of it, it looks like, has raised the barriers to entry to popular democracy. In other words, you and me, and one participating in our democracy to a level that we can't get past. And you've got, in just talking about the term limits with Bloomberg, there's collusion between the Democratic Party and Bloomberg, and people are afraid of Bloomberg because he's so rich. So he's got two instruments to clobber democracy
when
with.
When he started as mayor, he was the 65th richest man in America. Now he think he's the 8th richest man in America.
Right. Now, money doesn't buy you everything in politics. You still need the approval of one of the two parties. But it helps. And he's ramming this through against the popular will. We need a referendum. Like we probably would have needed a referendum on the bailout bill. If we'd had a referendum on the bailout bill, it wouldn't have passed.
Rick MacArthur, thanks so much for being with us. His book is You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. The latest issue of Harper's Magazine is about how to save capitalism. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're talking voting rights and a lawsuit being filed now in Pennsylvania. Stay with us.
Good.
Funky, down, nasty.
Hey, listen to the man.
Well, Godfather.
Payback.
Cold-blooded.
People, people, gotta get over before we go under. Down, Lord. People, people, we gotta get over before we go under. Hey, country, you didn't say what you meant. You just changed. Brand new funky.
James Brown, Funky President. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, with the election less than 2 weeks away, Republican John McCain is intensifying efforts in Pennsylvania, a state no Republican has won since 1988. Many political analysts say that capturing Pennsylvania's 21 electoral votes is key for McCain to win the White House. While the Pennsylvania race is being closely watched across the country, concern is growing that the vote will be marred by long lines at voting sites and problems with electronic voting machines. The state has seen a record number of new voter registrations. On Thursday, a group of voter and civil rights groups sued the state to demand emergency paper ballots be distributed when 50% or more electronic voting machines become inoperable at any polling site in the state.
The lawsuit was filed after Pennsylvania's Secretary of State ordered counties to provide emergency paper ballots only if every electronic voting machine breaks down at a voting site. The plaintiffs include the NAACP, the Public Interest Law Center of Philadelphia, and Voter Action. We're joined in our Firehouse studio by John Boniface. He's the legal director for Voter Action and founder of the National Voting Rights Institute. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having
Great
me.
To have you with us, John. Explain the lawsuit further.
This lawsuit is all about making sure that people are protected when they show up at the polls on Election Day in Pennsylvania. The fact of the matter is that these electronic voting machines have a long record of breaking down, not functioning on Election Day, apart from the issues around whether or not they can be counted as being accurately counting votes. But in this instance, we're dealing with a situation of long lines with high voter turnout. Combined with that, we see a potential perfect storm impacting the right to vote. When machines break down, they cause these long lines that turn people away. One of our clients, Angel Coleman, is a single mother. She's a grad student. She has a full-time job. You know, she showed up at the polls on Election Day during the primary. In April, we were monitoring a national election protection hotline at the time, 866-MY-VOTE-1. And she found that the line was very long. She could not stay in line. She had to get on to work. She was told that two of the three machines were down, and there was no indication of when they were going to be back up. She had to make childcare arrangements later that evening to show back up and vote. The bottom line here, Amy, is that people should not be forced to wait hours in line in order to cast their vote, and they should not be forced to go home and come back later. The right to vote is too important, too fundamental to require that.
Well, you mentioned Pennsylvania. I lived in Philadelphia for many years, and I distinctly remember back in 1978 when there were the electronic machines. There were the old Jamestown lever machines, and Philadelphia was infamous for breakdowns. And in 78, when Rizzo was trying to change the charter to run for mayor for a third term, all the machines in the black community were breaking down, and there was almost a riot on election day when the black radio stations called black people out into the streets to protest the fact that the polls were closing and thousands of people had not voted. They forced the Election Commission to leave the polls open several hours later for everybody to vote. But that was a near-riot situation. That was 30 years ago.
Right. Well, I think what we've come from that point to today is we've found that now we have these fancy computerized voting machines, 24 states using them, 45% electorate voting on them, in response to the debacle in Florida 2000 with the hanging Chad fiasco. And we took a disaster of an election in Florida, and we made it exponentially worse. And these machines are unreliable. They're insecure. California has decertified these voting systems, recertified them for only limited use. Florida and Iowa have shifted away from there. So has New Mexico as a result of a voter action lawsuit. But states like Pennsylvania and Ohio still have them in place. And the solution here has to be, aside from scrapping them all together and going to optically scanned paper ballot systems, is that in these counties, and there are 54 of the 67 that are using these electronic voting machines, we have to have emergency paper ballots on hand to be provided to voters when long lines develop because of voting machine breakdowns.
Talk about vote flipping concerns. We're already seeing, I mean, millions of people are voting right now in early voting. Explain what vote flipping is and where is this happening?
Well, we're monitoring two separate hotlines through InfoVoter Technologies, which has data stream from MyVote1, 866 MyVote1, and from a hotline promoted by CNN, 877 GoVote CO8. Go CNN 08, rather. These hotlines are showing that there are vote flipping concerns already developing in states like West Virginia, Tennessee, and Texas, where people are showing up for early voting and finding that when they go to the process of voting for President of the United States, they're punching the screen for Barack Obama and it's flipping to John McCain. Now, these reports are not unusual, unfortunately. They are reports that we heard in Ohio in 2004. They are reports we heard in Sarasota County, Florida, in 2006 in a hotly contested congressional race in which 18,000 missing votes occurred with a margin of victory of less than 400 votes between the two candidates. But what they do show, frankly, is that these machines cannot be trusted for accurately counting and recording our votes.
Are there any reports coming in of people who are voting for McCain and it's flipping to Obama?
Not that we've seen yet, but, you know, this is a concern across the board. I mean, we're a nonpartisan organization. We believe that the right to vote must be protected for everyone. But certainly the fact is that when voters show up at the polls and are trying to cast their ballot and they cannot trust whether their votes are going to be properly counted, that's a fundamental democracy concern.
Can you talk about privatized voter registration databases?
Well, what we see here is an outsourcing to private companies of key election functions, which not only includes the vote counting process of electronic voting machines, but also electronic poll books and privatized voter registration databases. We saw in New Mexico, for example, in the Democratic caucus in February, 17,000 voters showing up and having to cast provisional ballots because the private company Election Systems and Software, one of the big four election industry companies, ESNS, had created and maintained a flawed database. This is what happens when we lose public control and public accountability of the political process, and when we essentially outsource to private companies these key election functions.
And in terms of what voters can do to assure that their vote is protected on Election Day, what are your recommendations?
Well, first, we think people should demand emergency paper ballots if they're in these jurisdictions where electronic voting machines are being used. They should say they want that paper ballot option and they want that emergency paper ballot because that ballot enables one to conduct a recount or an audit. It is impossible unfortunately, to conduct any kind of meaningful recount or audit using electronic voting machines. But a paper ballot system, you have the voter intent reflected on that paper ballot even after it's been scanned to an optical scan machine. We also think...
But you're not saying that they should demand a paper ballot instead of voting, right? In case the machine is broken, you're saying?
Well, we believe, I mean, in the first instance, people should demand a paper ballot even if the machine's not broken.
Okay.
And now the lawsuit we filed demands that there be at least after 50% of the machines, 50% or more of the machines go down, the paper ballot should be distributed. But, you know, in Ohio, they give a paper ballot option. People should exercise that option up to 25.
Do those votes get counted?
They do get counted. And, in fact, in many instances, they're better to be casting the ballot on the paper, far better, than to be voting on the electronic voting machine, where you have no idea whether or not it's going to be properly counted. But, yes, of course they're going to get counted, and voters should exercise those options where they have them. Counties in Colorado are going to be providing that option for some in certain counties, and they should exercise that.
How can you practice voting? That may sound odd, but we are seeing the largest number of new voters, I think, in history.
Yes.
Registered. These machines are not easy or obvious.
No, they're not. And in fact, many poll workers, unfortunately, don't even know how to work them and what to do when they break down. I mean, the other whole piece of this is when a machine breaks down, you know, arguably the machine should be taken out of commission, not waiting for a technician for hours and to come and then somehow fix it when you don't even know whether it's actually been fixed. But, you know, beyond that, there's this basic point that citizens need to be engaged in overseeing the political process, in being vigilant about protecting the right to vote. That's why we're engaged with a national group of partners with us in monitoring this election, Watch the Vote 2008. And we really believe that citizen oversight is one of the true antidotes to encouraging and protecting the process. Well, it means that citizens are engaged at the local level, that they're monitoring their polling site, that they're showing up when there are problems, that they're responding to issues that they hear from either hotlines or from the local community, and that they're demanding of their election officials greater oversight. Most of these states do not audit the process, and yet we audit our financial transactions. We audit other things of value. We audit the most important thing of value, which is our vote.
I'm curious. You may not have the answer to this, but seeing as this problem crops up with so many other issues in American society, do you know to what degree the American companies that are producing these machines have begun penetrating the voting markets in other countries? In other words, in the third world and other places where they're now voting with the same kinds of machines?
Some of these companies are engaged in doing that in other parts of the world. And in fact, you know, there needs to be a full investigation of these voting systems companies. We've called for that. There is no real oversight at the federal level of these companies. They've marketed, frankly, a defective product in these electronic voting machines to the tune of making billions of taxpayer dollars. The state of Ohio has sued Diebold, one of these voting machine manufacturers, to return the tens of millions of taxpayer dollars provided to that company for marketing a defective product in the electronic voting machine. And we ought to have Congress intervene here. If, in fact, these companies knowingly marketed a defective product, then that's commercial fraud, and they ought to be held accountable for that as well.
This latest news of Acorn revising the tally from a major national voter registration drive from 1.3 million, saying they registered, down to 450,000, and the whole attack on Acorn, with John McCain saying it's the largest voter fraud perpetrated in American history.
This is a red herring. This is a total red herring. The fact of the matter is that whether or not there are fraudulent voter registration forms being submitted by some people who decide they weren't going to do the work and fill out Mickey Mouse doesn't mean that Mickey Mouse is showing up to vote on Election Day. There's no evidence whatsoever, no evidence whatsoever, that that's going to be happening. In fact, there's very little evidence that any of these kinds of claims of voter fraud actually occur. When, you know, you look at the overall prosecutions on this, it's 0.00001% of people who actually are showing up and committing a felony right there on Election Day by saying, I'm somebody that I'm not. It doesn't happen.
Do you need an ID to vote?
Well, it depends on what state you're in. I mean, in certain states, you do. And if you're a new registrant, then you do in certain states.
But what kind of ID?
A photo ID, unfortunately, in some states. I mean, the fact is that some of these states have imposed a very restrictive requirement.
What kind of photo ID?
you know, a driver's license depends. I mean, a lot of people don't have them. I mean, I think we're going to see a lot of people not being able to cast the franchise because of those voter ID requirements. But here's the bottom line, is that this election is only going to be decided by those who are able to access the ballot and to have their votes counted. If you show up on election day, you're eligible to vote, you're supposed to be on the voting rolls, but you've been purged, you've been taken off, and you don't get a ballot, you won't decide this election. And if you show up on election day and you vote on one of these voting machines and it doesn't possibly count your vote, then you won't decide this election. So whatever polls are out there, the most important point is that it gets decided by people who are able to vote and have their votes counted.
John Boniface, thanks so much for being with us. Legal director of Voter Action, also the founder of National Voting Rights Institute, actually ran for Secretary of State of the state of Massachusetts. Thanks so much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, the death date has been set for Troy Davis in Georgia. He's scheduled to die on Monday. We'll talk about his case. Stay with us. Thanks.
It all began when they took me from my home and put me on death row. A crime for which I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels. A ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup. Those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels. A hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting, in its way he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. My kill hand's tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five, they did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven his throne is made of gold, the ark of his testament is stowed, a throne from which I'm told all history does unfold. It's made of wood and wire, and my body is on fire, and God is never far away. Into the mercy seat I climb. My head is shaved, my head is wired, and like a moth that tries to enter.
Johnny Cash singing Mercy Seat. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Georgia death row prisoner Troy Anthony Davis is scheduled to be executed Monday night at 7 p.m. Early this month, the Supreme Court refused to hear Davis's appeal to have a jury hear new evidence that says that he says could prove his innocence. The court gave no explanation for its decision not to hear Davis's case. Last month, the court granted him a last-minute reprieve 2 hours before he was scheduled to be executed. Troy Anthony Davis was given the death sentence for the 1989 killing of a white police officer. Since that trial, seven of the nine non-police witnesses have recanted their testimony, and there is no direct physical evidence tying Davis to the crime scene. Davis's lawyers asked the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals Wednesday to stay his execution and allow them to file a new federal lawsuit based on innocence claims. The motion reads, quote, "Society recoils at state execution of an innocent person," and notes that executing Davis in light of new evidence regarding his innocence is, quote, "constitutionally intolerable."
We're joined now by two guests. Ezekiel Edwards is a staff attorney at the Innocence Project here in New York, specializing in eyewitness evidence. Laura Moy is on the phone with us. She's deputy director of the Southern Region of Amnesty International USA. She's joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, where hundreds demonstrated on Thursday, the Global Day of Action for Troy Davis. I want to begin with Laura Moy in Georgia. Tell us what the lawyers are doing right now. What we've seen most recently is Troy Davis has had two dates to die. The last one, he was within 2 hours of being executed when the Supreme Court stopped that execution. election. But now they will not accept an appeal of the case, and Georgia's scheduled to kill him on Monday. Laura?
Right. Well, his legal team has filed a motion with the 11th Circuit, and meanwhile, on the ground, we have a lot of activism planned for today and all the way up to Monday at 7 o'clock if we don't have an intervention by then. But one of the things that's also available to him, too, is that the parole board in Georgia has executive clemency power. In most states, it's the governor, not the parole board. But we are continuing to ask the parole board to reconsider their decision. We're appealing also to our governor, who doesn't have direct power, but we think he should be concerned about the reputation of our state and the confidence that will be totally lost by the citizens of Georgia should there not be an intervention before Monday at 7 p.m.
Has the parole board acted in the past in any capital case?
Yes, they have. In fact, earlier this year, there was a man named David Crow who was he had his sentence commuted by the parole board.
And explain the grounds on which, I mean, this has already gone to the Supreme Court. How are the lawyers trying to appeal this?
Well, as Juan was just announcing, the idea is that they're appealing to the idea that it should be unconstitutional that an innocent person could be executed. So it's a similar argument to the ones that they have been making all along.
Ezekiel Edwards, let's talk about this issue of innocence, when innocence matters, when it doesn't, and the eyewitness testimony on which this case is based.
Well, just for a little bit of background, since the Innocence Project was founded in 1992 by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, 223 people have been exonerated through post-conviction DNA testing. We've looked back at those cases and found that in 75% of them, mistaken eyewitness identification was a leading contributing factor. Troy Davis's case was based almost entirely on identification evidence. As you said earlier, of the seven witnesses who came to court, well, the nine witnesses, but five of whom were eyewitness witnesses. Seven were eyewitness witnesses. Five have recanted their testimony. Seven of the nine total witnesses have recanted their testimony. There has been now 30 years of copious social science research looking at the factors that affect reliability of eyewitness evidence. Troy Davis's case presents many of those factors, both in terms of what actually happened during the incident and the witness's opportunity to view, and also the procedures that the police used, all of which contravened best practices. What's outrageous is that, first of all, his defense lawyer actually didn't even try to suppress the eyewitness identification evidence at trial. He didn't ask that it not go to the jury. When it did go to the jury, he didn't ask for an expert to tell the jury what those factors were. He didn't ask for special jury instructions. And what's also outrageous is that not one of these witnesses has been heard in a court of law, not in Georgia, not by the Supreme Court. And so you've got somebody who has a compelling case of innocence with seven people coming forward and saying that they didn't tell the truth at trial, and no court has bothered to hear those witnesses.
And why is eyewitness testimony so unreliable?
Well, there are a few reasons. First of all, just the way that the human memory works, and there's been many studies. I mean, there have been psychologists from Hugo Munsterberg 100 years ago to Supreme Court justices in the late 60s who have been talking about the fragility of such evidence. When somebody sees an incident, the way that you encode it, the way that you then preserve it, and the way you retrieve it, there's all of these opportunities for contamination along the way. In Troy's case, the incident happened at night. It happened very quickly. There was a weapon present, so that would have been very stressful and distracting for the witnesses. On top of that, when the police conducted their identification procedures, it was the same officer doing all of them, and he knew who the suspect was, Troy Davis, and he knew that that's who they wanted the witness to pick. But even more egregiously, every single witness who identified Troy Davis at trial, who have now said that they lied, had seen a picture of Troy Davis prior to the lineup procedure, inclusive of his photo. Some had seen it on wanted posters, some had seen it on the media, some had seen it in the possession of the police. And then they were asked, in very suggestive circumstances, who did this. Now they're saying, in fact, they really didn't see who did it.
And some are saying that it's someone else who pointed the finger at Troy.
Yeah, adding to the outrage of this case is that one of the nine witnesses who has not recanted, there are only two, I'm sorry, one of the nine witnesses, two have not recanted, is a guy named Red Coles. And he is now suspected to be the shooter. In fact, at least five witnesses, I heard actually as many as nine, have now said that they either saw him do the shooting or
Red
that
Coles.
He, Red Coles, or that he confessed to them, including a family member and two good friends. No court has heard from those witnesses either. So they haven't heard from the recanting witnesses, and they haven't heard from the witnesses.
And what does Red Coles say? And where is he?
I don't know where he is. He certainly hasn't. Sorry if she has.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Red Coles lives in Savannah. He's alive and well. And he, as you said, he was implicated by at least nine people in sworn affidavits. Some people said that he's bragged that he killed the police officer. And it's interesting that Red Coles is the person who pointed the police to Troy Davis as the leading suspect. And from there, they built a case that it was Troy Davis. They did not cast a wide net to consider alternative suspects, including this man, Sylvester Coles, who had had a motive himself to shot the police officer.
And the motive was what?
Well, the police officer, was coming to the scene of the crime to somebody had attacked this homeless man. And if you take the theory that Sylvester Coles was the person who committed that act, he was trying to keep out of trouble. So, I mean, there's a very strong theory that there is this alternative suspect, and the police didn't really search that out, and the courts are unwilling to hear it.
And Laura Moy, is your sense that the part of the resistance to actually reopen this case is the reality that the prosecutorial misconduct and the police misconduct would also come on trial as well?
Well, that's very possible. I mean, the system and the folks involved have a lot to lose. If it comes out, that there was a police or prosecutorial misconduct, it really does not look good for them.
Ezekiel Edwards.
Well, I'd just add two things. One is that there was a lot of pressure put on these witnesses. They've all come forward and said that they were the police and prosecutors exerted immense pressure on them, and so I'm sure they don't.
And they've been threatened with perjury, and this alternative suspect has threatened some of them, too, as has been alleged.
And I also want to make the point that we're not even asking, like right now, Troy, it's not even about a new trial. He's been denied even a hearing where these witnesses can come forward to try to get a new trial. So no.
Why would the Supreme Court stop this? I mean, he was within 2 hours of being executed and the Supreme Court stopped it and then move forward. Why did they bother to stop it, Laura Moy?
That's so unusual because the county where Davis was convicted and sent to death row, Chatham County, that's Savannah. That the judge of the Superior Court there issued an execution warrant to have Troy executed a week before the U.S. Supreme Court came back to session in September. So I think the U.S. Supreme Court said, give us at least a week to come back and consider the cert petition that was filed with them over the summer. So the folks down in Chatham County are very anxious to get this execution done and over with. I think the U.S. Supreme Court felt, especially with all the attention, I'm sure, that, give us at least a week to come back to session and consider the cert petition.
But the Supreme Court didn't actually explain why they didn't take the case. They simply did it. And in addition to the fact that this is a very disturbing move by the Supreme Court, obviously for Troy Davis and for our criminal justice system, they are also rejecting to hear the decision by the Georgia Supreme Court, a 4-3 decision, that basically said if you have recantation testimony, if you have people who have come forward now and said, actually, at trial I was lying, unless you can pretty much absolutely prove that what they were saying at trial was false, like they've been convicted of perjury since then, or they were in another state and you can prove it, that testimony is not enough to get you a new hearing. So that has reverberations for many people in the state of Georgia, not just Georgia.
Laura Moy, we have 10 seconds. What are people doing right now? What are you suggesting people do?
Well, people should go to the website, amnestyusa.org, and you can still send your letter to the parole board. It'll be copied to the governor. We have a funeral procession planned in a couple hours. We're going to be delivering a casket with the word justice on it. We're going to be delivering over 140,000 petitions to the parole board. There are people who are writing letters to the doctors who are involved, Georgians for Alternatives to Death Penalty.
We're going to have to leave it there. Laura Moy of Amnesty International, Ezekiel Edwards of the Innocence Project, thanks so much. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.